So the title of this is Innovations in Maximum Likelihood Quantum State Tomography. At least that's the official title. But after having finished the talk, there were a couple of others that occurred to me, like experiences with or struggles with these things. So the main authors on this, I think, are myself and Manny Camille. And we have another list of experimenters there who are doing an experiment at NIST, and they want us to analyze the data. And so the theory that you're going to hear me talking about today is very closely related to this particular experiment that we're doing, and the needs to have efficient and honest methods to analyze their data. So here's the plan of what I want to talk about. First is the Schrödinger cat making experiment. The quote marks are to remind you that I don't really think it's a particularly useful name for what the experiment is doing, but it seems to be something that the community has settled on. So I'm stuck with it. So I will talk about what's going on in the experiment and how the data is produced. And then I will talk briefly about the current state of quantum state tomography. Then I will discuss some of the things that we have done to help, which is finding a stopping criterion for when you should believe you are close to the maximum likelihood state. I will describe a new algorithm that we have been using to find the maximum likelihood state and our methods to get approximate confidence intervals, which for which we use a bootstrapping resampling technique to do that, unfortunately. Then I will show the preliminary data from the experiment so far. So first I should talk about what are Schrödinger cat states. So I'm talking about the state of a single harmonic oscillator, which is different from other types of Schrödinger cat states, such as the actual cat who is in a superposition of live and dead, or the state in which you have, say, 10 qubits and they are in superposition of all of them being pointing up or all of them pointing down. So we have just a single harmonic oscillator system, and it is in a superposition of two coherent states, or just displaced vacuum states, plus alpha and minus alpha. It has plus or minus here, so the plus states have only even numbers of photons, the minus states have only odds, they're orthogonal. But there are some interesting things you can do with these, like use them as your qubit states for quantum information processing, or there are applications to use these kinds of states for sensitive measurements, these kinds of things. If you like the Wigner functions, here are a couple. This is just the coherent state, and here is a superposition of two of them. You can see they still have these Gaussian humps here, which should be the same size as this, but the graphs are not on the same scale. And then there are these exciting interference fringes showing the quantumness of the state or whatever. So these kinds of states have been made in a number of systems, such as light field trapped in a cavity, microwaves and superconducting resonator, which are also light fields trapped in cavities, motion of a trapped ion or traveling light waves, and there are probably others that I don't remember right now. And these so far have been created with mean number of photons of less than 10 or so, depending on what system you're using. So we want to make the Schrödinger cat states in a traveling light field. And the first suggestion for how to do this is to use a Kerr effect material, where we put in one coherent state here. It evolves under this Hamiltonian, which has got a term proportional to number of photons squared. And if you do it for the correct time, you'll get out the cat state you wanted. The problem with this is that current materials have too much absorption, so they ruin the coherence of the cat state you want to make, and the coupling constant is too small. There might be hope for doing this with EIP or some other exotic materials, but they're not functioning well enough yet. Yes, Robin?
Quick questions. One is, when you said these states have been created in various systems, presumably they haven't demonstrated creating perfect pure states.
Yeah.
What's your threshold for calling something a cat state?
Oh, I don't know if I've really thought seriously about what that is.
And this is just, I don't know the optics well enough. If I apply an n squared Hamiltonian, do I really get exactly a superposition of two Gaussian states?
Yeah. If you do it for the correct time, yeah. If you do it for other amounts of time, you'll get like a Gaussian states whose peaks lie on a ring in phase space. And if you do it for the right time, you'll get various configurations of those kinds of things.
Okay, but there exists a time for which I get exactly that state. Cool.
But I think more importantly, and often overlooked, is that we need the cat states for using them for quantum information processing or other things. So you want the cat states to be occupying a particular mode shape, that is, in their frequency, spectrum, spatial, time, mode. The mode should not change when you apply the Hamiltonian. Otherwise, they won't properly interact with states like these that maybe did not have this transformation applied to them, and it will cause all sorts of trouble for your quantum information processor. And the problem is that this sort of Hamiltonian is going to screw up your mode shape, and I don't see any way around that. So there are a number of other proposals for how to make cat states. And they all involve some lower order nonlinearity. I think these pretty much all have squeezing in them. Or a couple of them involve small Kerr effects. And then you do some measurement and you post select, believing that you have made an approximate cat state based on the result of your measurement. So the one that I will talk about today is this one here because it has the simplest looking picture. We call this photon subtraction, and in the photon subtraction, we start with squeezed light. So that's happening here in this crystal. The blue light comes in, it's squeezed. One blue photon gets converted into two red photons, and so you get the squeezed state. Then it's sent through a beam splitter, and there's a photon detector on one end of the beam splitter. And when it detects a photon, we think you will think you have made a cat state or an approximation of it coming out the other mode of the beam splitter there. But this basically works the same as a heralded single photon source, but we will use stronger squeezing and we get out different states in the end. So here is a comparison. This is an ideal state made by single photon subtraction, and this is a perfect cat state. So their Wigner functions look similar. You might say, but this perfect cat state doesn't look like the one you just showed me a minute ago, and it's because this one had far more photons. And if you imagine squeezing together these two Gaussian peaks, once they're close enough, you get this shape, which just has these little bumps here and here, and it also looks very much like a single photon Wigner function. So in our experiment,
this one is. Okay. I'm actually not sure. I don't remember if I made this one with the plus or minus. It must be plus because it has a high peak there in the middle.
Yeah. It doesn't matter so much except in the one where alpha squared is small.
Yeah. So in our experiment, we want to subtract two
or three or maybe even more photons. Overall, it looks like this. We start with some pump light, which we up-convert to twice the frequency, and then it is down-converted to half the frequency during the squeezing. So this, our squeezed light is made here, and this piece is kept for homodyne detection later. For the photon subtraction, we use the superconducting transition edge sensor, or TES. It's a kind of photon detector that can resolve particular numbers of photons. And their efficiency we estimate to be close to 90%. And they are very nice also because the dark count rate is limited only by the black body radiation entering an optical fiber, which couples the light to the detector, which must be kept at millikelvin temperature. That dark count rate of the detector is not the limiting source of problems for us, though. The biggest problem for us is purity of the squeeze state that we make. So we want to subtract more than one photon because subtracting more photons will make a higher fidelity, larger amplitude cat state. And we have made in this experiment these four data sets, which I'll talk about later. The first one is we are only subtracting one photon, and to do that, we use avalanche photodiode. We just subtract two photons with avalanche photodiode, or three, which the transition edge sensor, or two and three with transition edge sensor. So the probability to observe more photons decreases very quickly. So the data set here for one photon is much, much larger than the amount of events that we have observed with the three photons.
Well, I think that that's uninteresting reasons. But I don't know, they might be. First of all, the avalanche photodiode is much faster response, and so it's easier to gate the time that we use to accept photon events. So that helps us to reject some scattered light and that sort of thing. Also, it's just much easier to operate because it doesn't have to be kept so cold. So if we had APDs that could distinguish numbers of photons, we would probably use those all the time. To do the two photon measurement with APDs, we put an extra beam splitter here and two APDs off the side of it. So. So we did the measurements using homodyne detection. While we do that, we vary the phase of the local oscillator here, and we measure the difference in the currents coming from the two detectors,
and that gives us a measurement of the quadrature variables of the light that is there, which I'll call X. And we record in pairs of X and phi phase. It's also important that we calibrate this thing because we want to know what's the efficiency of the optical path leading after this beam splitter to the measurement, and including the efficiency of the photodiodes used in the homodyne detection. So there are several parts to the efficiency. There's the optical components, the efficiency of the photodiodes themselves, mismatch between the mode shapes of the local oscillator and the photon subtracted state that's there. Also, in the homodyne detectors, you will have some dark current produced by whatever electrical noise, and we can convert that into an effective loss of the signal light. We do all these things, and we think that the efficiency of the whole system is about 85 ± 3%. So that 3 ± 3% is an important source of systematic error, because we want actually to infer the state here before it has lost its signal. Yeah.
Four numbers, the 94, 97, 95, 97, those are measured empirically somehow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you not use whatever techniques are used to measure those numbers empirically to measure your overall eta empirically and reduce that 3%?
I was going to say yes until you said reduce that 3%. So you might imagine a scheme whereby you make a set some other known states, like a bunch of different coherent states here, do tomography on them, infer what they are, and use that to get an effective loss for the system. But the problem is that we can't make a source of known coherent states with uncertainty that gives better from that.
So how are the individual eta sub-whatevers measured?
By a whole lot of different techniques that will take a long time to explain. Most of them are made by making high-powered light that you can also measure
on some kind of calibrated power meter. And then you can learn the efficiency of some of these things at the high power and hope that it's the same at low power. Most of these things are done that way. If you want to ask for lots of details, you can ask later. So we have a forward measurement model to relate states to probability distributions for outcomes of these measurements. So that's just that we say that the measurement should be associated with some POVM element pi, which depends on the measurement result and the phase and the efficiency of the measurement, which I it doesn't change, so I'm not going to keep track of it in the same way. Rho is the state that we want, and there's some probability distribution over x's given y's. So this is an element of a continuous POVM for us, because our measurement space is continuous. And we calculate it this way. X is a harmonic oscillator position eigenstate. And this factor here is for a phase evolution. And we have En, which is the Krauss operators for photon loss on these states. And so we notice we're considering all of this stuff, including this efficiency, in our measurement operators. So we will use them to infer the state before the loss happened. So after we get all this data, we will do quantum state tomography using this set of observations. I'll index them with a small m, and there should be big N of them, and our forward measurement model. And our goal is to take this set and the model and infer the state that we've made. And so there are several schools of thought for how this can be done. There is linear inversion. So there is some linear relationship between the observations and the state. So the problem can be reduced basically to a matrix inversion problem. And that is easy to do, but the problem is that it often gives non-physical density matrices that have negative eigenvalues or other problems like that. There is a maximum likelihood method, which is what we will use. The goal of that is to find a point estimate for rho that would give the highest probability to observe the data if that state was the B state, or that gives the maximum likelihood. There's Bayesian inference, the goal of which is to take a prior probability distribution for states and update it according to the measurements you have made. I know Robin has written some things about this, but it seems to us that it's complicated to do that, and we're not sure about how to implement an efficient algorithm to do it. So if Robin has good ideas for efficiency of that, I'd like to learn about it while I'm here. So also there is a maximum entropy method in which you try to infer the state rho with the highest entropy that is compatible with the measurements you've made. I don't know of an algorithm for doing that either. So here's the maximum likelihood. Rob?
We're talking about data. Your X's represent charges or currents or something, right?
Yeah.
Is that integrated over some amount of time?
Yeah.
Wait, so you're gonna do many different values of phi. Do you take a single integration over some fixed time period for each value of phi to get a single value of x, or do you repeat that measurement many times with a fixed value of phi to get many x's?
So the way it works is we
just scan phi very, very slowly and take lots of measurements of x. So usually at each phi, there's only one measurement result.
Continuously, so your bin then is actually over a range of a small, tiny wedge of phi's?
Well, we don't make bins. We consider each result.
There's got to be a binning time somewhere in there, right?
So there's an integration time of how much charge.
Right.
And that time is much, much faster than the variation of the angle. Does that answer your question?
Enough.
But I guess, and nowhere in this do I consider
a histogram of data explicitly. Oh, I said that stuff. Okay, so we have a likelihood function, which is the product of the probabilities of all the individual measurements. And we can take the logarithm of that to get this log likelihood function. We're going to maximize the logarithm of the likelihood because that's easier to do, mostly because the log likelihood is convex. Also, when we're doing the maximization, we want to respect the constraints of density matrices, namely that they are Hermitian and their trace is one, and they have positive eigenvalues. So the previous method for doing this has been called R rho R, because that's a matrix product that you compute during the algorithm. And you begin it's a bunch of iterations with row naught, which is just the maximally mixed state. So here I have a fancy looking in, that means normalize the thing. At each step of the algorithm, we compute this matrix R, which is a function of each of the measurement results and the probability of obtaining that result at the particular, for the particular density matrix that you have now and the current iteration. Then we just multiply R row R to find the next density matrix. So at the maximum likelihood point, this is a fixed point. So R row R at the maximum likelihood will just give you the maximum likelihood state back. The big matrix R is positive and it's Hermitian. So every row I is also Hermitian, will also be positive. And we can normalize them with this N to make sure that their trace is 1. And there is a proof that the diluted algorithm in which R is replaced by the identity plus a small term times R, a small, this will always increase the log likelihood. Sorry for the typo there. It will increase the log likelihood if epsilon is small enough. But in practice, we don't run into this problem and we just take epsilon to be infinity and we do ROR undiluted. So the virtues of this procedure are that it always returns a density matrix. It has a clear method to incorporate measurement noise by adapting the measurement operators. I don't know. I don't think that measurement is really that virtue is peculiar to R row R because it can clearly be incorporated into other inference procedures. There's no need to parameterize row or use constraint equations to enforce its density matrix properties, and the implementation is relatively simple. But there are some desiderata that we are looking for. We want to know when is it a good idea to stop the iterations? How can we find an algorithm with faster convergence? So I'll show you in a little while that the convergence rate of the ROR is not particularly fast once you begin to be close to the maximum likelihood point. Also, we want to find a confidence region for the inferred density matrix or confidence intervals for and observables of the inferred matrix. So previous stopping criteria that we use before developing our new one are just do a lot of iterations. That's not particularly useful or even very informative. So we tried to compare the likelihood of the states found at each iteration. And we think, well, if the likelihood change between the two states is small, they must be getting close. We also compared the fidelity or trace distance between states at each iteration. And we say if the fidelity is high or the trace distance is high, we stop. But both of these things suffer from problems when you're not actually very close to the maximum, but the progress of the iterations is very slow. Also, we would like to have some kind of trust that the maximum that we have found is close to the actual maximum. So here's a review of how we found this dropping criteria. We're going to consider subsequent density matrices, rho and the next one, rho prime. And there is a direction in density matrix space sigma. And we're going to move a distance epsilon towards direction sigma in the next iteration. So first thing we do is expand the log likelihood function to first order in epsilon using Taylor expansion. This derivative of the log likelihood with respect to epsilon is just the trace of R sigma minus the trace of R rho. The trace of R row is just the total number of measurements you've made. So we get this thing here. So what sigma would maximize the new likelihood? We want to choose the direction in which we move to maximize this. And it turns out that this should be a pure state. and it is the eigenvector of R, which has the largest eigenvalue. So the new, we want to maximize this, and so the new maximum should be this much. The previous likelihood plus that. So we'll call this stuff here maximum eigenvalue of R minus N small r. And because the log likelihood is convex, the likelihood at rho plus r has got to be less than the maximum value. Yes?
Greater than or equal to. Which one is
that? Oh, yes, you're right. It should be greater than or equal to. So that places an upper bound
on what the actual maximum is based on your knowledge of the current density matrix. By the convexity of this, the value of, so this is the actual likelihood function, and this is just a line whose pointing in the direction of sigma.
This distance you could move?
Yeah, by construction of this thing.
So because the function is convex, it can't exceed the slope, the tangent slope at this point. So if you know the slope, you can bound the maximum value of the function.
Likelihood, right?
Yeah. So therefore,
we have the stopping criteria, stop when R is small. And that will give you confidence that you're close to the maximum likelihood, which is useful. So here's some comparison. We graph here the value of R, or so the blue line is R, the stopping criterion, and the green line is the actual difference between the maximum likelihood, the log likelihood, and the current known density matrix. So our upper bound is significantly larger than the actual value. It would be nice to have a tighter bound than that. Over here, I've graphed 1 minus the fidelity on log axes. So you can see that the ROR iterations are moving very fast at the beginning. Then they have this little kink where they can't, their rate of convergence gets to be much slower. And so if you want to have fidelity of, say, 10 to the minus 4, you may have to do lots of iterations. And the change in each the state at each iteration is pretty small. So we have a bound, but it's not very tight. There's a significant gap between our bound and the actual maximum. Also, I would say that bounding the log likelihood is good, but I wish we had a bound on, say, the fidelity between the current state and the final one. I think both of those things are useful. Bound on the likelihood is good because sort of from an inference perspective, if you are close to the maximum, you're going to be close to whatever sort of confidence region of density matrices that you would have in mind if you're going to compare likelihoods. So now I will tell you about a new algorithm have been using to find maximum likelihood state, which we call the regularized gradient descent. Can we find an algorithm that converges faster? The answer is yes. But you'll see that it's not clear that it's always practical to use it. The strategy is to use traditional ideas of gradient descent and construct a trust region over which a quadratic approximation of the log likelihood function is useful. We're going to over-parameterize the density matrix rho in a way that can make the optimization unconstrained. And to stay within the trust region, we're going to restrict the step size at each iteration. So here's a parameterization of rho that we use. Rho sub I is a density matrix known at a current iteration, and I plus 1 is the next one. So we have here the square root of rho I plus some matrix A times the square root of rho plus A dagger. So this the matrix A can be any complex matrix as long as it's the same size as rho. This construction ensures that we always find new density matrices. But to do this, we have increased the parameter space from b squared minus 1 to 2 times b squared, where b is the Hilbert space dimension. Yeah.
Math cal n is again. Oh, normalizing. Oh, okay. Yeah, so you can
just divide by the trace of that stuff and get the. So we will use this parameterization to make a quadratic approximation of the log likelihood. So say delta is some expression that is second order in this matrix A, the parameterizing matrix A. And this here is just the second order expansion of the log likelihood, which is second order in delta. Then we'll write A as a long 2 times b squared element real vector. So we just take the columns of A, write them on top of one another, and break that into real and imaginary parts. So we have now parameterized it using a set of real parameters, which are unconstrained. And we have some matrix M here expressing quadratic correlations, I guess, and some vector V, which is only first order. The pain of this algorithm is computing this matrix M because it's high dimensional, 2d squared dimensions, or 4b to the fourth elements in it. And it requires that you do the sum over every measurement observation you have made.
Normalized here? Yeah, I don't see the normalization in this.
I'm not sure what normalization are you thinking of.
I see the rho. Okay, so rho I plus 1 is a normalized version of what you do. You apply this thing to, you apply A to, you add A to rho, do that thing, then normalize.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, got it.
So this will be normalized because delta has a trace of 0. And we don't normalize the likelihood.
The vectorized gradient and Laplacian of your log likelihood, right?
Yeah, well, it's gradient and Laplacian of the log likelihood expressed as a function of all the parameters of the matrix A.
Right.
So that takes maybe a lot of sweat when you're programming MATLAB, but I think the idea is basically simple.
We construct a second order approximation of the log likelihood function in this parameter space of A. So the next step is we choose some maximum step size, which is the norm squared of A. So the purpose of that is so that A doesn't get too large. If A is too large, then we will exceed the region over which the quadratic approximation is valid or useful. Then we just want to maximize the log likelihood at the next density matrix subject to the constraint that the step size is not too large. And that can be done using method of Lagrange multipliers. And we get this expression here for A. And lambda is some Lagrange multiplier, which we set to be the maximum eigenvalue of M, just to make sure that this is always invertible. And we increase the size of lambda if necessary in order to keep the step size small enough. So it might be possible to solve for lambda such that your step size is exactly S, but we don't bother to do that We just want some step size that's smaller than that, which might not be efficient, but it's easy. So here's a review of the steps in the algorithm. The first is choose a step size, and we start with s equals 1, not for any particularly good reason. It can be smaller or bigger. From the current density matrix, you calculate this vector v and the matrix m. You find the maximum eigenvalue of m and set lambda equals to that, and you compute the new a. Then you check to make sure that the step size is not too big. If it is, you increase the size of lambda and compute a again. Okay, so after you have found an a whose step size is small enough, we calculate the new density matrix. Then we use an exact expression for the log likelihood to make sure that we have actually increased the size of the likelihood. If your step size is too big, you go outside of the quadratically valid region. And the only way we know if that happens is that we have found a new log likelihood that is too small. So if that happens, we just reduce the step size, and then we'll probably have to change lambda and calculate these things again. So that's the structure of the.
This method for root finding, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's actually Newton's method,
since Newton's is only first order, but it's like the second order. A second order kind of
zero of the derivative.
Yeah.
Of the light.
So is it, I guess this will converge so much faster that it doesn't matter that you're doing matrix multiplications with much larger matrices. Is that what's going to happen?
Yes.
But I wouldn't say it doesn't matter that you're doing that. So here are some comparisons of amount of time that these things take. So the blue lines show R row R.
And the green lines show this regularized gradient descent. And these numbers here, tell you how many R row R iterations you can do in the same amount of time that it takes you to do one iteration of our gradient descent method. And we have, I've shown graphs here for 10 and 20 photon cases. So that's the size of the Hilbert space, is the number of photons plus 1. And here are 2,000 measurements and 20,000 measurements. So you see the R row R line looks like almost continuous because it's doing so many more iterations. And the gradient descent line has these clearly visible kinks. I mean, this is the time from here to here is one iteration of that thing. And so to make these graphs, I told the algorithm just stop when you find a place that the stopping criterion R is 10 to the minus 2. So that's why you see that this line stops here, but this one seems to keep going. And the reason it does that is because it's found a place here that's like 3 times 10 to the minus 2. And then the next step, it goes all the way down to almost 10 to the minus 5. So what we see is that in the beginning, it's pretty slow. But once you get close, it converges much faster. And which one is faster, I guess, ultimately depends on the number of dimensions in your Hilbert space, the number of measurements you have made, and how close you really want to get to the maximum.
Yeah. That you're working with is 1 plus the number of photons.
Yeah.
So we can do, I guess, the obvious thing, which is we start off with several iterations of R row R, and then we switch to this gradient descent that we're using.
We couldn't find a particularly rational reason to switch based on like knowledge of the current density matrix or anything like that. So we're just taking a number of R row R iterations that is equal to the time that it would have taken to do one iteration of the gradient descent. And so the red line shows that, and it's significantly faster than either one for these. It takes advantage of the very fast convergence that you get at the beginning of the R row R. So now I will talk about the bootstrapping method we are using to infer confidence intervals for functions of our density matrix. We take the original experimental data in which there are big N points, and we use that to find the maximum likelihood state. Then we use the maximum likelihood state to simulate B new data sets. Each of the new data sets uses the same list of phase angles for the homodyne measurement, and it's got the same number of measurements in it. And so to do that, we just take use phi m, which is the same one from the previous inference, and we take the maximum likelihood state that we knew there, and so we just need to use some Monte Carlo method to sample from this probability distribution to obtain the measurement result x that goes into that data set, yeah?
By simulating.
I mean, in my computer, I use the, we assume for the simulation that the true state is the maximum likelihood state that we infer. And then we use that to generate the set of data.
So which parts are you simulating? Because you could just calculate what you would get for a particular measurement. Which part are you simulating?
So we can't calculate what we would get for a particular measurement because the result is random. But the result is given by some probability distribution. Right? The probability distribution is determined by the current state plus our model for what the measurement operators do to that state. Maybe I don't quite understand. But okay, let me tell you what we're not simulating. We're not simulating different efficiencies for the measurement, for the homodyne system, or other error sources. We assume that we know the efficiency of that because we calibrated it. Of course, there is uncertainty for that, and that's important. But we're not simulating that as far. We're only simulating the statistics of choosing measurement results from this probability distribution.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I quite understood your
So basically, so. Starting from where you had that, that beam splitter to start your measurement. So everything with eta in it, that part, this is your model for the measurement.
Right.
Right, so for each of the simulated data sets, we find the maximum likelihood state for it, which we label with a B. Then we're going to use the this set of resampled density matrices B to calculate some parameter of interest. Maybe it's the fidelity with a perfect cat state or something like that. It doesn't really matter for the purposes of the talk what we want to infer, but I'll talk about fidelities later. So then we obtain some distribution over fidelities using the resampled states. So here are some histograms of inferred fidelities, resampled inferred fidelities. And so here's the fidelity, and this is the number of times we observe the fidelity in that bin. This data was from the subtracting one photon, and there are 300,000 measurements in it. And the resampling, I've only used 100 resampled data sets. That's because it takes a couple of days to do all this. And we have to simulate all the measurements. That takes a bunch of computer time itself. And then we have to do the whole maximum likelihood inference 100 times. So it's painful, yes.
24,000 separate values of phi?
Yeah.
Wow.
So in the graph, the long red line shows the fidelity of the maximum likelihood state inferred from the original experimental results. And all the others show fidelities for our 100 resampled states. The two short red lines mark the central 68th percentile region of this histogram. And we see that this resampling procedure is clearly biased toward having lower fidelities than the state that we started with. So what fidelity I'm talking about here is the fidelity between the maximum likelihood state and a perfect cat state. We search over cat states to find the one with the highest fidelity. And you might ask me, suppose if you searched every one of your 100 resampled sets for the cat state that matches best that one. The histogram looks almost exactly the same in that case. Yeah.
Okay, you said Schroeder red lights mark central 68th percentile. I don't understand that comment.
Oh, that means that 16% of the in the resampled states have fidelity lower than that, and 16% of them have fidelities higher than that. So 68% of them have fidelities between the two red lines. Okay. So if you knew that the resampling inference procedure was not biased, you would probably say that these two things mark our 68th percentile confidence interval for the fidelities. But since it seems to be biased, we probably shouldn't say that.
But the bar right after has 20 of them in there. See, I thought you said...
Oh, yeah, you're right. So maybe this line should be moved over. I drew the lines in my hand, so they might not be as accurate as they should.
So why do you say the resampling is biased towards lower fidelity as opposed to saying that the maximum likelihood procedure is biased towards higher fidelity?
Okay.
Is there any reason to say
one? No, maybe I didn't choose my words carefully enough because I would agree with both of those statements, I think. Maybe I... And we see similar bias when we look at what's the negative, this minimum of the Rieger function. So here is another data set with fewer measurements, only 40,000. I did 100 resamples again from these, and this one is not obviously as much biased. I don't know why. So you've been asking lots of questions about what exactly is the relationship between the bias and the number of measurements and the purity of the states, and I'm sure there are lots of interesting relationships there that we don't know about yet.
Do you know actually anything about the purity? Can you say something about the purity of the states?
No. I don't know exactly what the purity is.
And are these states that are output by our algorithm typically full rank, or do they have?
Yeah.
Do they reach the boundary and sort of truncate and have less than zero eigenvalues?
So they never have exactly zero eigenvalues. Our algorithm doesn't find that. But they always have.
You're coding in MATLAB. If you type rank or whatever the function is, you hit enter, is it going to be the size of the matrix or is it going to be less?
It is.
So these are numerically dependent. Full rank. But I guess it's probably also true that there's a pretty sharp decrease in the size of the eigenvalues, such that if we were to order the spectrum of this density operator, the least eigenvalues would be negligible.
Yes, that's true. But I'll say a couple more words about that later in the concluding remarks. So here's the
three photon subtraction experiment. It has only 1,000 measurements, which is arguably not even enough to consider trying to do inference. That number is so small, but that was several days of data taking, and that's what the experimentalists were able to produce. So this histogram is particularly funky looking to me, and it's much faster to do the resampling procedure when you have only 1,000 measurements. So I did that. So here's the same system where I've now done 800 resamplings, which is the number I could do in one night of about 8 hours, I think it was. So this still looks, the histogram isn't as crazy looking as it was before. It's still significantly biased looking. So we want the procedure for correcting the bias. And I have a really nice thing that goes through various steps of justifying what the procedure is, but I'm running out of time, so I think I'm going to skip most of that. But the conclusion is that we're going to assume that distribution of fidelities produced by different, by generating data from different density matrices are different only in the sense that they move left or right along the axis. So if you generate data with some other state, it's different from the fidelity histogram generated by the maximum likely state only by this constant factor that shifts the distributions over. So is that a reasonable assumption? So here's the histogram I just showed you. And here's another one that is close to it. It's close in the sense that the ratio of their likelihoods, I think, is about 0.8. And so I'll flip back and forth a couple of times. You can see how those two distributions are different. So one thing you might notice is this one does not look as biased as the other one. So I say that the histograms look similar, but this relationship is not exactly true. So one would sure like to have a method to correct for even for that, but I don't think it's going to be very easy. If you make this assumption, we can show that we can upper bound bound the fidelity of the true state, its lower bound and its upper bound, using the fidelity of the maximum likelihood state and its upper and lower bounds. So let me show you the results of doing that. Here's a chart that shows fidelities of the states here. And then these columns is the four different data sets, and I'm showing you the fidelity plus its like 68th percentile region for the state, and then again after it has been corrected for the bias in the procedure. The diamonds are the rotated squares are the fidelity of the maximum likelihood state inferred from the actual data, and then this line shows the region of the bias corrected bounds on the fidelity. So you notice here, this is the most dramatic one because it's the one where we have the most uncertainty. The fact that the data is biased actually gives us evidence that the fidelity of the true state is significantly higher than the fidelity that we inferred from one instance of the maximum likelihood procedure. So are there any questions of that? Also, we should include some uncertainty that's related to the calibration of the experiment and figuring out this effective efficiency for the whole thing. If we choose different efficiencies, we infer different maximum likelihood fidelities. Because if we believe that the system was less efficient, we will infer a state which has suffered less loss or maybe more pure. So to reflect this, I've just increased the size of these little squares here. So you can see that when we have measured around 300,000 measurements, our uncertainty from this systematic effect is about the same size as our uncertainty due to the statistical inference procedure. So here are some conclusions. We formulated this maximum likelihood stopping criterion, which bounds the true maximum of the likelihood function. We use this new gradient descent algorithm, which has faster convergence when you are close to the maximum point. But it might not be practical in all cases, depending on what you really want to get out of your experiment. Also, I think it's worth noting that this function can actually, the regularized gradient descent method can actually be used to optimize any convex function of density matrices. There was nothing in that construction that was particular to it being the log likelihood function. we use this parametric bootstrap resampling with a bias correction technique to correct for the low purity bias of the maximum likelihood inference, but it requires a strong assumption on similarity of the histograms made from different states. And we have in the experiment created approximate cat states by subtracting 3 photons. The photon number is fairly large compared to other similar experiments that have done this, but the fidelity needs improvement. I'm not sure how close you were paying attention there, but the fidelities are just above 0.5. Fidelity of 0.5 can be made by just producing a coherent state. So to do better in making high fidelity cat states, we are going to need higher purity in the squeezing. So before I end, I want to list some open problems. We need a method for more rigorous confidence intervals that don't require all the pain and the time and the computational effort of resampling. And while I'm here, you can ask me about other things we have tried and didn't work. And that's why we've resorted to using the bootstrapping technique. Also, I want to have a test for the number of photons required in the density matrix. So we looked at different methods for doing this. And the problem is that by including a larger number of photons, you can always achieve a larger maximum likelihood. You can always fit your state better by including basically more parameters in the fit. And in fact, this seems to eventually cause some kind of overfitting problems. If we include more and more and more photons, we don't really produce states of significantly lower rank. Or I should say that the rank seems to increase actually as we add more photons. The inferred probability for finding really large number of photons does not dramatically increase. You might hope it would decrease exponentially, but it doesn't seem to do that, at least over the regions we have been looking. It's like that probability never seems to get significantly lower than something on the order of the 1 over the number of measurements times 1 over the number of dimensions in the Hilbert space. I don't know if that's just numerology or if it's something real. So what else was I going to list? Oh, we want a good method to perform Bayesian inference because I'd really like to compare the results of these procedures. And we want to know how to make high purity single mode pulsed squeezed light so that the fidelity of the state is actually higher. So that's everything I have.
I'd just like to square the suggestion you made that there's a bias towards lower purity from your results, and Robin's claim that maximum likelihood overestimates any climax function. So is there a conflict between those two statements? Or?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll let you two talk
about I don't know what Robin's claim is, so I don't know what.
Yeah, that's sort of an unfair sandbagging.
Yeah, so I was just curious.
Since the question's been asked, what is the argument? You argued or you stated in your conclusions that there is a bias towards low purity. Whence cometh that argument?
Right, so maybe I shouldn't say low purity since I haven't actually calculated purities. But that claim cometh from this observation, basically, that this is this is fidelity with the closest pure state. But I've also looked at negativity of Ringer functions.
Sorry, closest pure state or closest cat state?
The cat states are assumed to be pure, so it's.
But there might be a pure state that is not a cat state that has much higher fidelity than the closest cat state, right?
Yeah, so I mean cat state.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. But I think that might confuse the argument, so let's talk about the negativity of the Wigner function. So there is some feeling that if the Wigner function negativity is very negative, then it's more pure. And at least that doesn't compare to some other state, the property of the particular state itself.
So if you take the state you have inferred from the maximum likelihood procedure, its fidelity is this. If you sample data from it, you find that the fidelity of the state you obtain from the sampling is very likely to, or very probable to be lower than the fidelity of the, or it's than the fidelity of the state you have used to produce the data.
So first of all, the statement here is that resampling is biased towards lower purity.
Yeah.
Right? But I think in your conclusions, I thought it said that MLE was biased towards low purity.
Yeah.
Those seem to be different statements.
I think that the resampling, I mean by that, sampling data and then doing maximum likelihood procedure on it. And so I don't have any reason to think that the sampling is producing bad data. The sampling just uses this model.
I see what you mean now. Second question.
It's the maximum likelihood inference done to the resampled data.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean now. That was a good answer. But when you went through this the first time, I thought you said that the ideal cat state was the cat state that was closest to the maximum likelihood state. In other words, the pure state with the highest fidelity with rho MLE.
Mm-hmm.
But then you calculate these resampled states that form a cloud around rho MLE, and that fidelity is the fidelity between the best pure fit to the MLE. So I think that's where you're getting this from.
Right. So I know that that's what one might think, which is why I say we have done exactly the same procedure for a negativity of Wigner function, and we see the same bias behavior there. We also see the same procedure. We also see the same biasing if we do the following procedure. We instead of making histograms of the fidelity with the states obtained through resampling with the state that is closest to maximum likelihood, instead we will, for each of the resampled states, find a cat state whose fidelity is closest to it. And when we graph, when we do a histogram of those fidelities, where each one has found its optimal cat state, it looks almost exactly the same as this. We see the same bias. Hmm. In fact, the histogram looks almost exactly the same because the difference in these states is not, this is my own intuitive interpretation. I haven't done much to check for this following claim. But it seems that the cat state that they each find is almost exactly the same, but the fidelity that it has with its partner cat state is lower because it has apparently suffered from more decoherence or something like that. So I'm confident in saying that the maximum likelihood procedure is biased. And I don't think that's a surprising claim. The maximum likelihood procedure is biased if you want to estimate the variance of the normal distribution. The maximum likelihood estimate of the normal distribution is biased. That's why when you are learning statistics and undergraduate, you have this mysterious procedure of putting n minus 1 in the denominator of that expression for the inferred variance. Because inferencing procedures are usually biased. I don't think it's surprising that this one is. So are there other questions?
I'm actually kind of surprised that you're having problems with convex optimization. I thought convex optimization was the easiest thing to do.
What do you mean by we're having problems?
Well, you're having, so even with the out of row R, you know, you're having I suppose it is converging, but it's taking a long time to converge. And I thought convex optimization is a problem that has been.
Yeah, we're done. It is.
So
that's why we wanted to move away from ROR, because it didn't seem a particularly intelligent way to find the maximum. It does, and it's simple, but I guess that I don't see any particular argument that this multiplication of ROR is a fast or efficient thing to do. So that's why we try to use these more traditional methods of trust region.
Yeah, I suppose my question was, like, why not try other methods for context optimization before...
That's what he did.
Before making up your own, there are a bunch of complex optimizations.
So we wanted to, basically we wanted to make up our own because at least complex optimization programs that I know of don't always respect the constraints that we want to impose on the density matrix. So we wanted a simple way to embody those constraints that we can use
without explicitly parameterizing the function.
Yeah, because I want a program that I can easily run on a density matrix of any size. So I don't want to have to worry a lot about how to parameterize. And I'm sure that there are algorithms that would run faster than mine.
Andrew Doherty. And some collaborators spent a while applying the sort of state-of-the-art in convex programming methods to MLE, and then they never published it. But it has been done. But, I mean, the sort of Newton's method type thing is a pretty good way of doing this problem. You're using a second-order gradient method basically Newton's method. You look at the gradient, you look at the second derivative, and then you leap to the optimal point for that quadratic approximation.
Yeah, we don't actually leap all the way to the optimal point, but we leap in that direction.
Okay, right, because you have your S parameter.
Yeah.
But over the years, over the last 10 years or so, a lot of people have coded straightforward linear gradient methods, where you don't do the quadratic approximation, you just say, well, which direction is the gradient going, and now I'm going to take some step size, and then you can plug in any kind of adaptive step size routine you want. It seems like it'd be very easy to turn your code into one of those. Did you compare?
No. I mean, that's on the list of things we like to do, but I haven't looked at that yet. And I think that there are lots of things that one could do to our code to make it faster that we haven't really needed to do, and so we haven't done yet.
No more questions? Okay, so let's thank Scott again.